Hey, I'm Bruce Weinstein, and this is the podcast Cooking with Bruce and Mark.
And I'm Mark Scarborough, and together with Bruce, we have written 36 and are writing the 37th cookbook over a course of almost 25 years. We've published all those books with New York publishers, and we've developed on our own almost 20,000 original recipes. It's hard to even fathom it. Well, except my waistline may tell you something. Anyway, this is our food and cooking podcast about our passion, food, and cooking. We've got a one-minute cooking tip about tablescapes of all the crazy things. We want to talk about how we like and dislike certain foods and the reasons why, which are changing even as we speak. Believe it or not, research is coming out, and we want to tell you what's making us happy in food this week. So let's get started.
Our one-minute cooking tip. Did you know you can rent your entire tablescape for a dinner party?
Stop. Okay, I'm going to stop you and say, I can't believe you used the word tablescape. That is so gross. Isn't that like that Sandra Lee semi-homemade lady?
Tablescapes, I mean, it's your plates, your silverware, your napkins. Well, maybe not everybody listening does. And napkins, runners, flowers, candlesticks.
Yeah.
All of that makes up your tablescape.
What happened to just set the table?
Well, what if you like to change things up? Okay. You want to do something different. You only have one set of dishes. Right. You don't have time to shop.
Only one set of dishes, you're not gay. Okay, do go
and
on.
Let's say you don't even have the creativity to make a table gorgeous. Not everyone is as talented as you are, Mark.
It's true. I do all the tablescapes. Word feels, I feel dirty just saying the word. I do all of the decoration of the table and setting the table for the dinner parties. But Bruce is right. You can, in fact, rent tablescapes. And in fact, they show up and you just put the dirty dishes in boxes or cartons.
And mail them back.
And they just take them back.
Literally mail them back. So there are services that let you pick online the exact design you like.
Like what service?
Tableandteaspoon.com. There's one called Hestia, H-E-S-T-I-A, Harlow.com. Just Google tablescape rental and you'll find a whole bunch of them. You pick the style you want. They pile everything into boxes and ship them to you. What kills me is you put everything dirty back in the box.
I know. Doesn't it stink?
Not only that, doesn't that attract like rodents in the mail and all that?
But
it's not my problem. It's going back.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
So no, it's not.
NIMBY. The whole world is NIMBY. Okay.
It's not cheap, but it's cheaper than buying new dishes.
Well, I'm laughing now. Okay, yeah, right. If you buy new dishes for a dinner party, you are definitely gay. You're definitely part of our tribe.
But these are great because you can get everything. You can get all the place settings, the silverware, the napkins, the runners, the candlesticks, the candle holders. It's kind of crazy.
Well, it's like, I guess, a wedding rental kind of thing.
It is. But most of them have a minimum of four people. So you can get four settings and one runner and candles and all that.
Wow. Well, what do you know? All right. So rent your tablescapes. Ugh, that word. Rent your tablescapes next time from places like tableandteaspoon.com. We are not underwritten nor sponsored by any of these various websites and producers. Before we get to the next segment of our podcast, which is all about likes and dislikes of food, let me say that we do have a newsletter. It comes out, I don't know, twice a month, maybe even once a month. It depends. Right now we're in book production, so there's no newsletter forthcoming right at the moment. But you can get on our mailing list on our website, bruceandmark.com, or cookingwithbruceandmark.com. You'll find it right there on the opening page. If you drop your name and email there, it goes straight into a locked box. Oh, I sound like Al Gore. On the server, I don't even let our mail list provider capture your email. It cannot be sold, and you can unsubscribe at any moment. All right, on to the next segment of the podcast. That is the likes and dislikes of food.
Researching this segment, I felt vindicated. My whole life, I have not liked certain things, and everyone always said, oh, you're so picky, and blah, 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 blah. But did you know that we are actually programmed to some extent to like and dislike certain foods?
Okay, so we are. But let me back up and say that there was a time not so long ago, in fact, in our food career, when all the research seemed to be indicating that babies pick up cues, environmental cues from their parents about what to like and dislike. And this still holds. It's not that this has been contradicted. Mm-mm. It still does hold. And, you know, here's the thing. If you are feeding a baby, your baby, let's say. And,
I hope you're not feeding other babies.
Well, okay. Well, anyway. And so you go to Spoon, and let's say you have pureed Brussels sprouts, you know, out of the jar.
Oh, and God, I nasty.
See, and you have that look on your face because you think, oh, this is disgusting. The baby doesn't know it's disgusting or not. And so what the baby does and what babies are great at doing is reading cues, particularly on their mothers and somewhat on their father's faces. And so the baby sees the fear. It picks up the cues of that kind of thing. And the baby backs away from it. And ultimately, these lead to likes and dislikes. Once upon a time, this was the only way people thought about food likes and dislikes, but genetic research has changed so much in the last 10 years.
It has. At the University of Colorado School of Medicine, there is a whole study going on to try and find genetic predispositions to certain foods. They look at the human genome and they study people and see what they like and don't like and what do they
share. Give the geneticist her credit.
Her name is Joanne Cole.
There you go.
And so what her team has found is that some of the genes that have the strongest effect on diet are taste receptors, mm-hmm. especially bitter-tasting things. So you are built to taste things the way your parents were built to taste things.
Well, and I think the bitter thing is really crucial because, of course, so many toxic and poisonous substances mm-hmm. are bitter. But if you have a really pronounced bitter receptor or rejector in your genetic code. For example, you're not going to like broccoli and you're not going to like right. cauliflower. Now, let me say that every one of these studies indicates that you can learn to like these things. So although you're predisposed, you can learn eventually to like these things with behavioral training.
But still vindicated.
Okay, but the initial bit here is, let's say, cruciferous vegetables like cauliflower and broccoli. Those are particularly bitter, yep. and they ring up certain genetic encoding in you
right.
to want to stay away from it. For example, I love broccoli, and I love cauliflower, and I even loved broccoli as a little kid. So clearly, the genetic marker is not as pronounced on me as it is on some others.
Right, and the team also found a very specific olfactory gene connected to the smell of cheese alone. Another one for the smell of fruit. Another one just specific to tea.
Okay, I just have to think about this for a minute. So they found a special olfactory gene connected to the smell of cheese, and humans have not been making cheese for that long. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, let's say I didn't do any research on this, so I don't know. But let's say it's been 4,000 years. Let's push it all the way back to Homer and the Odyssey, and let's say people were making cheese then. But that's not a long time for a gene to develop in sequence. So that's wild that gene would be there.
Maybe the people that had that
associated with cheese.
Maybe the people that had that gene all along are the ones that developed cheese because they were actually looking for that smell.
Maybe.
And there's another one I found really interesting. A genetic variant that explains your ability to smell something called beta ionine. It is a compound found in tobacco, in grapes, in spearmint, and tea.
In wine. In wine, too.
It is. And having this gene variant may dictate whether you end up smoking or whether you end up drinking tea.
And let's just say I drink a cup of tea almost every afternoon, a cup of hot tea. I drink a cup of hot tea even in the dead middle of summer almost every afternoon. And clearly, I'm kind of genetically programmed to like it because I didn't grow up with tea. I mean, I did grow up with tea, but it was incredibly weak Lipton tea that my mother, oh gosh, can I tell you this story? So my mother would take the tea bags and she would put that in the tea and then, you know, she'd use one tea bag for like two or three cups. And then she would take the tea bag and set it on a little saucer at the side of the sink and let it dry out. And the reason we did that is she was saving it for the missionaries. Can you believe this? And we would pack up all these dried up old tea bags and mail them off in care packages to the missionaries. And I always thought as a kid, I didn't have a calling as a missionary because I didn't like weak tea. Ugh. So it must mean that I'm not meant to be
Those
called to the mission
field. People are out there working in the world. Give them some fresh tea. But so many things about smell are genetic. There is a genetic component to smelling things. We know that. Like, for instance, you know when you eat asparagus and your pee stinks? Well, the funny thing is, I mean, when I eat asparagus, my pee stinks.
When I eat asparagus, my pee
and,
stinks.
You know, my father died a long time ago, 40 years ago. So I decided to ask my mom last time we saw her, did Dad's pee stink when he ate asparagus? I mean, it seemed like a normal question to me.
Of course, that seems totally normal. Totally within the bounds of communication with your mother. Do go on.
And she had no idea what I was talking about. And I said, well, you know, like when you eat asparagus, doesn't your pee stink? And she goes, I don't know what you're talking about. So I always believed that some people's pee stank after asparagus and some didn't. Turns out everybody's pee stinks after eating asparagus.
Right.
It's just that not everyone can smell it.
It's the genetic marker. You have to have the genetic marker to be able to smell it. Mm-hmm. We're shooting our next cookbook, our 37th cookbook right now. And we just, I know this is so weird. We have the weirdest conversations. But we just had this conversation with the photographer. And he was the same way. He was like, what are you talking about? I don't think so. I've never noticed anything about asparagus. And we both said, oh, you're lacking the genetic marker mm-hmm. that allows you to smell. It's a very odd thing. In fact, I find it so offensive that I have actually said I don't want to eat any more asparagus, and I still do. Mm-hmm. But I find it such an offensive smell that I actually want to stay away from it. Studies have also shown that there may be biological processes underlying the liking for highly palatable foods. And let me just say, we know this. We know that you are genetically predisposed to want sugar. It has to do with wanting your mother's milk and wanting the lactose in milk. And so we know you're genetically predisposed toward the sweet. But in fact, there may be more to it just than that.
MRI scans have found a correlation between the part of the brain involved with pleasure processing and the genetic variation linked to highly delicious, palatable foods.
Right.
And they know this because low-calorie and strong-tasting foods correlated with areas of the brain associated not with pleasure, but with decision-making.
Oh.
So you got to make the decision. Do I want to eat this bad-tasting thing?
Oh, well, you know, do I say this on a podcast? I guess I'm a very decisive person and a very opinionated person. You probably know that from this podcast. A very opinionated person. And I also really like strong tasting foods. So maybe that's connected genetically in some way. I really despise kind of wan, vapid foods without any taste.
That's why you don't like Pinot Noir very much.
Sorry, wine industry, but I don't like Pinot Noir. I like really heavy, big red wines. I love apois and stinky cheeses. I love organ meat of all sorts, from livers to spleens to lung. Yes, I've had lungs in my life and love lungs. I'm connected to these things. An Italian study, to go on, found a genetic link connected to the flavor of salt and the enjoyment of salt. And in fact, researchers discovered a specific gene that encourages some people to consume more salt than others.
I must have that gene.
Well, I must have it too.
Because I'm one of those people that will salt my food before I even taste it.
Yeah, I know. We're recording this. We just went through Passover Seder. And the meal was delicious. Did I salt everything on my plate before I even tasted it? Yes, I did.
And that really, really upset our host.
It did.
His wife does the same thing, and that really upsets him too.
He's like, taste
your food first.
No, I can't help it. I just want more salt on everything. We are in this photo shoot that I have mentioned already a couple times. And part of what happened in this photo shoot is that we put out some, what were those, pita chips or something? Mm-hmm. They were just boxed store brand pita chips. And they were so salty and they weren't very good tasting.
No.
But I couldn't stop eating them on set because they were so salty.
They were salty.
I was driven right up to it.
And the Wheat Thins were so sweet. We opened a box of Wheat Thins to use in a shot.
Which I haven't had in a million years.
Those things taste like, Mark kept saying, they tasted like lifesavers.
Yeah, I did. You might as well have a lifesaver if you're going to eat a Wheat Thin. They were so sweet.
Well, first ingredient was flour. Second ingredient was sugar.
Yeah, and I am much more attracted to salt than I am to sugar. So I think that this is all part of it. I mean, I made some vegan chocolate chip cookies a couple weeks ago, and they were from Phil Corey's book, A New Way to Bake. We had Phil Corey on the podcast, and these chocolate chip cookies are made with Maldon salt sprinkled over the top of them. They're vegan cookies, and they're made with Maldon salt sprinkled over the top of them.
Good.
And I know, the salt just knocked me out. So
I love salty things. I love salty granola. I love salty cookies.
I love salty granola. So in the end, we're influenced early on by our parents, but there is a genetic component to this. And if both your parents hated artichokes, there's a good chance you will too. And it may be because they themselves projected that dislike of artichokes onto you. It may also be because they have genetic markers that preclude them from liking cruciferous and bitter vegetables. And they have now passed that genetic marker onto you. There are actual, in fact, studies, as we've indicated here, that say that taste is partly genetic. But we should also say that every researcher is very quick to say that in most cases, dislikes can be learned to be overcome, which is really interesting. And I just say before we end this, this was my case with cilantro. I hated cilantro for years. When I met Bruce 27 years ago, I absolutely despised cilantro. I know, as a Texas boy, how could you hate cilantro since it's on like everything Tex-Mex? And I didn't like it. And over the years, I've come to like it. I still wouldn't eat a cilantro sauce. Mm. I still think I would steer clear of, like, I've seen recipes for cilantro pesto where it's just all cilantro, and I think to myself, oh God, I'd rather eat glass than eat that. But I like cilantro in things, and I like cilantro added to things now. So that clearly has been a way that I've taught myself to like something.
And when Mark and I first met, I did not eat fish of any kind. In fact,
what was your dictum?
My identity was, I will not eat anything that lived in water.
You did.
Period.
It didn't matter. That means frogs are out. Turtles are out.
Fresh water, salt water. It didn't matter. Wouldn't eat goldfish. I wouldn't eat guppies.
I probably won't eat goldfish either.
And I wouldn't eat tuna. I wouldn't eat anything. And now I love fish, and I have learned to like it.
Remember when we went to that restaurant in New York City, that Japanese restaurant, and we were served the bowl with the little fish in it?
And you had to drink
it. And it was a live fish swimming around in this bowl, and it was saltish water. It wasn't terribly salty water, but saltish water. And this little fish was swimming around in it. And the deal was, you just picked up the bowl and downed it with the fish.
That
and all.
I couldn't do.
Yeah, and it was live and swimming around.
I wouldn't do that.
It was so weird. It felt so weird and kind of crazy. But see, all of that is within my wheelhouse. But cilantro has always been without my wheelhouse. And I'm also, again, attracted to really strong tastes. Like, for example, if I never – oh, gosh, the wine industry is going to hate us. No, we're never going to be sponsored by the wine industry. But if I never drank a glass of white wine for the rest of my life, I would miss it.
I would.
But I would miss red wine.
I would miss a good white burgundy.
Yeah, I would.
I would miss champagne.
Well, champagne, I know champagne is white wine, but I don't count that in the category. Champagne is its own thing, and I love champagne. But most white wine I am completely indifferent to. But red wine, that to me is fabulous because, again, I'm driven toward much bigger tastes. So there is probably a genetic factor involved. Before we get to the final segment of this podcast, it would be great if you could rate this podcast, give it 5 stars, dare I ask. And if you could write a review, even just great podcast, that would be terrific. We are unsupported and have chosen to stay that way over the years. So the way you could help us and support us is simply by rating and even writing a review of this podcast. That would help a great deal. Okay, off to segment 3, the traditional end of our podcast. What's making us happy in food this week? And I'm going to start.
Okay.
I never start. I always let you go first. I'm going to say that we had friends for dinner a couple weeks ago, and Bruce had been teaching a knitting workshop in Needham, Massachusetts. So he was kind of overwhelmed by the weekend knitting workshop Bruce does knit, in case you don't know, and has published knitting books, in case you don't know. And he was doing this, so I made dinner. And one of our friends came from New York City, and she brought this box of these spectacular vegan chocolates. And they were made with marzipan, with almond
base. Yeah, the marzipan centers.
But the marzipan was so creamy that they acted like chocolate creams.
Mm-hmm. And they were flavored
like chocolate.
Some
creams.
Were just plain almond. Yep. Some were chocolate coconut. Some
raspberry.
Were coffee. Some were raspberry.
Yep.
They were delicious.
And they were beautiful in the box. Mm-hmm. Like the ones that were raspberry were in a diagonal across the box. And there was this little sprinkling of raspberry powder mm-hmm. on a diagonal line across the box. They were beautiful. And they just tasted really good. Yes. Did I know that they were not creams? Yes. But they were vegan, and that made it just so incredible on so many levels.
Mm. What's making me happy is kasha varnishkas.
Oh, there you go.
I don't get them very often.
No.
If you don't know what that is, kasha is toasted buckwheat.
Yep.
And to make kasha varnishkas, which is a good Jewish food, you fry onions in chicken fat or schmaltz till they're golden brown. You add the kasha, you add bow tie pasta, and you bake it up so the top of them are crunchy and a little dried out, and the bottom are soft and greasy. And kasha varnishkas, they're a good thing.
I think that kasha varnishkas are one of those things. I love them, but I think they are connected to a childhood memory. I mean, people do have great memories of food from childhood and connect to it. And I think that's one of those things that is probably for most people a childhood memory, because I don't think most people like toasted buckwheat, but I do.
I love it.
Because I like big taste. And if you don't know, toasted buckwheat is a big flavor.
It is. I remember in Seinfeld when they talked about George Costanza's father and that he had this aroma that was like a potpourri of dandruff and kasha.
Yes. There you
nice.
Go. Very nice. And your mother does not like kasha varnishkas.
My mother loves buckwheat, but she doesn't like when you toast it and turn it into kasha.
Yeah, because it is a big, bitter, strong, herbaceous flavor.
She claims there was a bad childhood memory about kasha.
Yeah. See, and so this again, this speaks to genetic, environmental, memories, the stuff from your hippocampus. What you like and don't like is a complicated soup of problems inside of your biology.
It is.
That's our podcast for this week. Thanks for being along on this journey with us. We certainly appreciate your spending time with us.
And every week we tell you what's making us happy in food. So tell us what's making you happy in food this week at our Facebook group, Cooking with Bruce and Mark. And if they're really great things that are making you happy, we're going to talk about them here on Cooking with Bruce and Mark.